A Heavy Weight is intended for mature audiences. This series discusses topics that may be triggering to some listeners, such as suicide and drug use. Some names in this series have been changed to protect identities. Views expressed by guests on this series are their own and may not reflect my own. Resources and source materials can be found on our website, aheavyweight.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't yet listened to the first four episodes, stop here and start at the beginning. A Heavy Weight re-examines the disappearance of Joseph Smedley. We ended the last episode on Friday, October 2nd, 2015. The body of 20-year-old IU student Joseph Smedley had just been found in Griffey Lake. His sister Vivian, who'd been desperately searching for her brother all week, remembered the moment she first heard that a body was found in a local lake.
When that Friday, when the police department called me and asked me to come in, they didn't say they found him. They just said they wanted to talk to me and ask me some questions. So I knew that I was the first point of contact because they did send out like a news story that said a body was found, but that was it. It was very like general. I kept like actually refreshing to see if they would give more information. I never did. They said that a fisherman found him floating in the water.
The local fisherman who'd spotted Joseph called the police upon discovering his body. Up to this point, the Indiana University Police Department had handled Joseph's case. But Joseph's body was found in Griffey Lake, which was outside the university's jurisdiction. So the case changed hands and Bloomington police took it over. When Vivian first arrived to the BPD precinct that Friday evening, it was already getting dark and it was raining. The police had not yet publicly confirmed that the body found was Joseph, which is why she was surprised to see someone else close to the case already at the station.
But when I got to the precinct, which is what the other roommate of Joseph, he was already sitting outside on the steps, waiting almost, like, to see if we were coming, or I don't know. It was just very weird that you think, oh, a body's found, and now here you are at the precinct before we've even gotten there. You know, you'd think the family would be the first people to show up, but that just, to me, proves more that they knew that it was him, because we didn't even know it was him.
We had to obscure the name of Joseph's roommate to protect his identity. This is the person we've been referring to as Ryan. Seeing him waiting in the rain at the station was strange. It's an image she's never forgotten. Without talking with Ryan, I can't say what reason he would have had for being there at precisely that moment. There could be a logical explanation for his presence, but I'm not sure what it could be. Seeing Ryan waiting in the rain as she arrived to identify her brother's body was only the first peculiar occurrence that evening. Vivian sensed that there were details about her brother's investigation that hadn't been shared with her. That feeling only intensified once BPD took over Joseph's case. Vivian had felt good about her relationship with IUPD's lead detective, Rebecca Schmiel, during those first 5 days following her brother's disappearance. But when the case changed hands, she immediately noticed a dramatic shift in how the investigation was being handled.
It wasn't until his body was found on that Friday that when the jurisdictions changed, Bloomington Police Department took over and just shut everybody out of the case.
Vivian didn't feel like BPD was giving her the full story. When she was called in to the precinct on Friday, October 2nd, to identify Joseph's body, the officer she spoke with failed to mention that her brother had been found with 66 pounds of rock in a backpack tied tightly to his body. In fact, BPD never shared this critical detail with her. She found out about it from local news coverage of her brother's case. The fact that this was omitted in her conversations with BPD left her deeply unsettled. Why wasn't this seemingly important detail shared with her when it was already public knowledge? It didn't sit well with her. At the BPD precinct, officers had gone over the items that Joseph had been found with, and they explained to her he'd been identified by the contents in his backpack. So besides 66 pounds of rock, what were those contents?
And they said he had like some old school papers, a hard drive, an external hard drive, and a charger to his laptop.
Vivian was also told that Joseph had been found with binoculars around his neck.
And like his papers would have been all soaking wet. So I don't know how they would have identified him from papers in his backpack. It was just because they said that's how they identified him. Because I don't believe he had a wallet, but I remember him saying they identified him from the contents of his backpack.
She had trouble making sense of the information being presented to her by police. With the few details she'd received from police, combined with what she heard in the news, she felt that something simply wasn't adding up. There was something else Vivian found out that Friday, something upsetting. But this time it wasn't about BPD's communication with her. It had to do with how Indiana University had handled Joseph's case.
It wasn't until that Friday when his body was found that they even informed the students of any situation involving him. And I just think that that's awful.
While Vivian was busy carrying out her own investigation after her brother's disappearance, she assumed that IU would have informed the student body that Joseph was missing. But according to her, that didn't happen until Friday, October 2nd, a full 5 days after he was reported missing. After local news confirmed that the body found in Griffey Lake was Joseph, IU students began reaching out to Vivian, telling her that this was the first they'd heard of his disappearance.
They're all just so upset because they're like, we didn't hear about this. Like, we were on campus and we had no idea this was going on.
Understandably, she was troubled by this. At the time, she'd been an IU student herself, up in Indianapolis at a different IU campus. And she received alerts from the school all the time.
I was going to IUPUI at the time, and I mean, you know, if someone punched someone on the street, like any time there was any kind of bad situation, anything that was reported to police, like IUPUI would sends an alert and you get a text message. So, I mean, it got to the point where I had to like turn it off or like put it on silent every time because they would come all the time, especially with being in like downtown Indianapolis. So, I mean, I know they've got the capability and I know that, you know, they're affiliated with IU. So how would IU be any different?
I reached out to the university multiple times in an attempt to clarify exactly when and how students were notified about Joseph's disappearance, but I received no response. I also asked if anyone from IUPD could comment or give any insight about Joseph's case, and this was the only response I received. This case was a matter handled by the Bloomington Police Department because the investigation was not within our jurisdiction. For that reason, IUPD really doesn't have information to discuss about the case. IU keeps a daily crime log that is published on the university's website, but I'm not sure if Joseph's disappearance would have been published there. Failing to immediately report Joseph's disappearance to tens of thousands of IU students and staff would have been a massive missed opportunity to find potential witnesses during the most critical days of the investigation.
So it's like, why wasn't Joseph being missing important enough? He was a student. He was living there. You know, like, he's part of a fraternity. Why weren't you informing your students that he was missing this entire time? Who knows? Like, maybe between that time frame, he could have still been alive, right. And a student could have known.
Like, oh, I just saw him down the street. Like, yeah. You know, stuff yeah. like that.
Vivian was extremely frustrated by the breakdowns in communication. And as she said earlier, she felt BPD shut her out almost immediately after taking over Joseph's case. Once she'd identified Joseph's body at the precinct, she was informed that his body was being taken for an autopsy. After that, she continued to check in with BPD regularly, but she said her calls went mostly unanswered. When she finally got a call back from BPD, the response she received was disappointing.
When I finally got the phone call from Bloomington Police Department, they called me and they said, hi, we actually just want to get the number to your dad. At this time, I didn't even know my dad was involved, because he's just been out of Joseph's life for so long.
Although their father had been absent from Joseph's life for nearly 5 years, Vivian passed along his phone number to BPD. She wanted to help her brother's case in any way she could, but she was skeptical her father would be able to help more than her.
And I'm like, well, what do you need his number for? Like, he's not part of this. Like, I filed him missing. I'm the one that's been doing all the work this whole time. And, you know, I have all the information about him. He can't even tell you how tall he is right now. Like, you want to talk to me.
BPD officers got in touch with Joseph's father, Joe Sr., and decided he would be the only point of contact in their investigation, even though he'd been estranged from his son for years.
And it was almost like they were intentionally trying to just cut me out from the very beginning, because they knew that I was so passionate about finding out what happened, whereas you have this other person who's completely removed from the case, hasn't talked to him in a long time, isn't asking the right questions, and that's the person that they decided they wanted to talk to.
After BPD contacted him, Joe Sr. drove down to Bloomington with his wife at the time to meet up with detectives so they could bring him up to speed about his son's case.
We went down to the Bloomington Police Department. Now, meanwhile, Vivian was doing all of the having all the discussions with the police, and she was doing her interviewing and that kind of stuff that you probably know about. Mm-hmm. And Vivian and I weren't that close because of the divorce situation, some issues that we had.
As Joe Sr. began getting more involved in Joseph's case, he also attributed the communication breakdowns between BPD and Vivian to having something to do with her determination and trying to find out what happened to her brother.
So when I got involved, it was like she was kind of running her own investigation, which was fine with me. But what happened was, at least according to the police department, the Bloomington Police Department, she had been making some allegations, and she kind of turned them off. Mm-hmm. And they decided, since I was his parent, mm-hmm. and she turned them off, they didn't want to work with her.
Joe Sr. felt that his initial interactions with BPD were positive.
They initially appeared to be really cooperative and answering my questions and that whole kind of thing.
But before long, he too became suspicious that he wasn't being told the entire truth about Joseph's case.
So the caution that I had, some of the red flags that I had come up was, they had they initially called a meeting and asked and invited me to attend. And I came. It was my ex-wife at the time, her daughter, and I. We drove down to this meeting, and three of us sat in, and it was almost everybody. It was the chief of police, a couple of lieutenants, a couple of sergeants, the coroner, and the sergeant who pulled his body out of the water, or at least he was there, who turned out to be the sergeant that was in charge of narcotics. And he is the one that I had the most initial interactions with. And he was friendly, cordial. And he's the one that told me that he was there when they pulled Joseph's body out of the water. And then he carefully made it point that he didn't see any unusual marks of anything that had happened to him. He don't saw no scars or anything, bruises. And then he, at some point, much too early, in my view, he said, well, the body's been in the water for about 5 days, and I recommend that, you know, you cremate it.
According to Joe Sr., this meeting took place shortly after Joseph's body was recovered and before autopsy results came in. Joe Sr. didn't say much in response to the officer at the time, but he and his wife found it inappropriate for an officer to suggest cremating Joseph's body.
My former wife had been a cop. She spent 17 years on the Indianapolis Police Department as a cop, and she rose to the level of sergeant before she left the police department. And, she was really helpful with me in terms of trying to figure out how to proceed with understanding what happened to Joseph.
It was in the same early meeting with BPD that Joe Sr. came to hear the prevailing theory about Joseph's death.
Yeah, the coroner was this woman. She right away, and I'm not sure whether it was a situation where it was one of her assistants or her, but she right away put the word out that drowning was likely a suicide. So I'm trying to wrap my head around what's going on.
Joe Sr. didn't only hear this from BPD. Local media also reported that Joseph's death was likely a suicide.
That's what the first thing that hit the papers in Bloomington in the southern Indiana.
The theory of death by suicide didn't sit well with Joe Sr. There wasn't any evidence to corroborate the theory, and even though he hadn't played an active role in his son's life lately, he could tell that something was off.
So I in the meeting with the entire police department there and the coroner, they were asking me, and they said, well, do you have any more questions? I said, yeah, I have a question. I said, in this room, there are years and years of police investigation work and death, homicide, suicide. I said, I have one question. And they said, what? As a chief, everybody was there. I said, does it make sense to anybody in this room?
Since his wife at the time was a police officer, she and Joe Sr. had already done some of their own investigating when they'd first arrived in Bloomington.
At that time, my wife and I had gone to Griffey Lake to the spot where they pulled him out. And it was in the evening. And as we were leaving, it was getting darker. And, you know, that's in the woods. There's no lights there. And there's an area there where kids hang out, you know, with a couple picnic tables. There are no lights, yep. You know. So we noticed that as we were leaving. So I said to them, does this make sense to anybody in this room with all of the years that you all have, that a person would, that is intent on committing suicide, would go down in the woods and strap a backpack to themselves and pick up rocks and put the rocks in the backpack in the dark where you can't even see your hand in front of your face, and then jump off to commit suicide in a lake with an average depth of 3 feet. And I got total silence. Total silence. So so from that point on, my wife at the time and I, we started our own investigation. Number one, and I had some conversations with Vivian about her investigation.
Vivian wasn't getting much information from BPD before her father became involved in Joseph's case. But once he became the point of contact for BPD's investigation, Vivian told me BPD wouldn't speak with her at all. So Vivian and Joe Sr. decided to work together as best they could to help solve Joseph's case. By this time, Vivian had also heard on the news that Joseph's death was a suspected suicide. And like her father, she wasn't buying it. Before we get any further, I think it's important to review what Vivian had confirmed about her brother's last movements. We went over these details as they came up in previous episodes, but it's important to revisit them again to really understand what happened to Joseph leading up to the night of his disappearance. I'll post a timeline of what I'm about to outline on our website, so you can follow along as we go and reference it as needed. A few weeks prior to his disappearance, in early September 2015, Joseph moved into the Mitchell Street house with his fraternity brothers, who we've been referring to with the pseudonyms Josh and Ryan. He left his previous apartment before his lease ended. He owed a balance of approximately $600. Unknowingly, as the co-signer of this lease, his sister Vivian was the guarantor for this outstanding balance. On Monday, September 21st, 2015, Vivian received a call from her brother's former landlord, letting her know that she and Joseph had until noon on Monday, September 28th, to pay the balance owed. On Saturday, September 26th, Joseph went out with his friend Jess and a few other friends. Nothing out of the ordinary happened that night. The group stayed up late until about 5 a.m. Sunday morning. On Sunday, September 27th, Joseph ate at Noodles & Company downtown near the square with a group of fraternity brothers around 1 or 2 p.m. This was the last charge on his bank card. A few frat brothers stopped by Joseph's Mitchell Street house around 8 p.m. Sunday night to watch football and catch a glimpse of the blood moon. Joseph reached out to a few girls on Sunday to see if they'd like to check out the blood moon, but he made no definite plans. Joseph, Josh, and Ryan watched a movie together Sunday night and all went to bed around 10:30 or 11 p.m. Vivian spoke with her brother Sunday evening to make sure he was set to pay the apartment balance the next day. Their conversation was normal, and Joseph assured his sister everything was taken care of. Joseph chatted with a girl through Facebook Messenger Sunday afternoon until late Sunday night. He invited her to a party at the fraternity house the following Thursday, October 1st. His last sent message with this person was at 11:23 p.m. Sunday night. According to his roommates, Joseph left the Mitchell Street house sometime after 10:30 or 11 p.m. that same night. Joseph didn't have a working car at the time. Vivian received a text from her brother's phone at 4:15 a.m. Monday morning on the 28th. She doesn't know if there were any other outgoing calls or texts from her brother's phone from 11:23 p.m. until 4 a.m. The ping from the text at 4:15 a.m. was near 7th Street and Walnut Street in downtown Bloomington. Joseph's next cell phone ping was about 4:45 a.m. Monday, 30 minutes after the text to Vivian. The ping was near Lake Griffey Reserve, where his body would be recovered 5 days later. The final ping that Vivian knew about was from around 6:30 a.m. Monday morning. An hour and 45 minutes after the 4:30 ping near Lake Griffey Reserve, the 6:30 a.m. ping was near Old State Road 37, which is near Griffey Lake. We posted a map of these locations on our Instagram account and our website so you can see the approximate location of the pings. At the time, Vivian was told by detectives that her brother's phone was likely turned off after the 6:30 a.m. ping. She is not aware of any other location pings. Joseph's body was recovered from the southern portion of Lake Griffey on the evening of Friday, October 2nd. This is everything that Vivian had been able to determine so far, and she shared it with her father. Based on this information, they both had a lot of unanswered questions for detectives regarding Joseph's last movements.
I gave him his information, and then Joe just basically became the middleman between me and Bloomington Police Department because they wouldn't talk to me.
Joe Sr. continued to bring himself up to speed about his son's case while he and Vivian awaited the autopsy results.
We met with the chief of police. She told us, my wife and I, they were aware of Joseph and they were aware of his activities. And she said that they were aware that Joseph had been selling in some small quantities of like marijuana to maybe some frat brothers or something. Mm-hmm. And but they said, we know he's not a drug dealer, you know, but we are aware that he's, you know, done this. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay. And they had a file on him. My wife looked through it, and but they wouldn't let us take anything from the file or give us any copies. Mm-hmm. So that raised another red flag and the reason why that raised a red flag was because when my cousins in Chicago, when they found out about it, they had just watched a program on CBS News. I think it was 60 Minutes or something. And this was ironic. And she called me and she said, did you see that 60 Minutes news report on this issue about confidential informants, college students? And what they discovered was that across the United States, almost all college campuses, there's a phenomenon that goes on whereby if they bust a kid with drugs, they force them to be a confidential informant. So I did a little bit more research and I found out that Bloomington Police has done that. They have used confidential informants. In fact, there was a black football player, young guy, I found out, who they caught with drugs and they forced him to be an informant. Being an informant is a skill and something that the police should do, not students, because that's dangerous.
Yes.
And so the whole purpose of that story was several of those kids have been murdered.
Yes.
Because they tried to set their supplier up and got caught. Mm-hmm. And one of them met with a drowning.
You may have heard of the case Joe Sr. is referring to. It's about North Dakota State Colleges of Science student Andrew Sadek. Andrew was arrested for a petty marijuana possession charge in 2013 and was forcibly coerced into becoming a confidential informant, a CI. He disappeared on May 1st, 2014, and his body was found months later in Red River in Minnesota. He'd been shot and his body weighed down by a backpack full of rocks. His death was determined as suicide, something his parents dispute to this day. While there are several big differences between the two cases, there were enough similarities for Joe Sr. to wonder if his son could have been used as a confidential informant. At first, this idea might seem far-fetched. I was skeptical of this theory at first. But once I started delving into the use of CIs on college campuses, I started to wonder if Joe Sr. might be onto something. In my interviews with Vivian, we discussed the group chat she'd found on her brother's laptop, which we reviewed in episode 3. She had more to share on the topic.
The fraternity was involved in drugs. It definitely talked about that, and they definitely talked about that in their GroupMe chat. But what's even funnier is in the GroupMe admits that he's the one that started getting Joseph involved in that.
The name you heard obscured is the real identity of one of Joseph's fraternity brothers.
That's the other thing is I talked to Rebecca Schmuel about that, and you know, I've given her all this information about them and their drug situation, and like they didn't do anything with it. Like, okay, separate from what's going on with my brother, you guys are fully aware that there's this big drug ring with all these fraternities, and you're not doing anything about it. I mean, this is a college campus, and they know what's going on. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Vivian and Joe Sr. had to wait nearly 2 months before the autopsy and toxicology reports would be returned. While they waited, they both tried to work out their own theories about what could have happened to Joseph. Was it possible he'd been a CI? Had he gotten mixed up in something dangerous going on at the fraternity? Could he have found out something he wasn't supposed to? Could he have known too much about someone? These were just some of the questions Vivian and Joe Sr. were asking themselves. And when Joseph's autopsy report finally came back, they were even more certain that there must have been foul play involved. But that's next time on A Heavy Weight.
So for him to kind of turn Joseph into this person that is doing something bad when he's the one that introduced him to whatever was going on in that fraternity, it just doesn't make any sense.
I have come across that before where students have been used as CIs.
And we basically told them, we suspect the Bloomington Police Department.
Heavy Weight is written, produced, and hosted by me, Stacey Brodovsky. Edited and engineered by Joseph Caldwell. Additional editing, music, and sound design by Mike Brodovsky.